researchers announced two major discoveries last week in the world of physics, and Wisconsin scientists were at the center of both. We'll talk to two of those scientists about what they observed, starting with gravitational waves. After gathering more than 15 years' worth of data, scientists at the North American Nanohertz Observatory for Gravitational Waves, or NanoGrav, announced new evidence of low-frequency gravitational waves that ripple through the fabric of space and time. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Now, have you been following this story since it came out in the news? Is there something you're curious about, confused about as to what this all means? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Sarah Vigeland is an assistant professor of physics at UW-Milwaukee. She's also chair of the Gravitational Wave Detection Working Group at NanoGrav. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with the basics. What are gravitational waves?
Gravitational waves are ripples in space and time that are produced when massive things move. Now, you and I are much too small to create gravitational waves that could be observed using any means that we know of. But gravitational waves are produced by really, really massive things like black holes. And that's really useful for astronomers because black holes, well, they're black. They don't emit light, so they're hard to see using conventional telescopes. But when they move, they give off these ripples. And by observing them, you can use those waves to figure out things about the sources that generated them. Things like how far away are they? How massive are they? How fast are they moving?
The thing I have a hard time wrapping my head around is what exactly is waving? And I think it's space itself? What's going on?
That's exactly it. So if you think about, so in general relativity, massive objects deform space and time, they warp it. And then if that massive object moves, the way that space is deformed has to change. And the information about that change is kind of spreading out throughout the universe, okay, in the form of these gravitational waves.
Now, talk us through how NanoGrav detected these particular gravitational waves. This is not something we can detect with the naked eye or anything like that. What went into this?
Right. So we've basically created a galaxy-scale gravitational wave detector, and it's because the galaxy is filled with these special kinds of stars called pulsars, and pulsars act like clocks just sitting out in space, ticking away. And that makes them ideal for measuring changes in space and time. Okay. So we monitor these pulsars. And by monitoring them, we can detect very tiny changes in space and time, which are produced by gravitational waves. So in essence, we have a gravitational wave detector that's spread throughout our galaxy. And then we use that to see gravitational waves coming from distant galaxies, coming from, for example, two black holes orbiting one another in a distant galaxy.
We've seen some past discoveries of gravitational waves, higher frequency ones. Can you tell us what those were versus what's involved in this new discovery, these lower frequency waves?
Sure. So the first gravitational wave detections was made in 2015 by the LIGO experiments. They use lasers to detect high frequency gravitational waves. So those are gravitational waves created by things that are changing on timescales of seconds. Okay. So in the case of LIGO, they detected two black holes about the same mass as our sun crashing into each other. So this is kind of sudden event where space-time is changing very suddenly, but then it's over after the collision, after the merger happens. Okay. What we're seeing is a completely different type of source. What we think we're seeing is coming from two supermassive black holes. So black holes, millions or billions of times the mass of our sun, orbiting one another, and they're orbiting relatively slowly. They're orbiting maybe once every 10 years, 50 years, something like that. And so space-time is changing, but on very long timescales. Because of that, LIGO can't see the gravitational waves that we see. And conversely, we can't see the kind that they see. The experiments are really very complementary in the same way that optical telescopes and radio telescopes are complementary. They both look at light, but they look at different kinds of light.
Talking to Sarah Vigeland, physicist at UW-Milwaukee, chair of the Gravitational Wave Detection Working Group at NanoGrav. You may have heard about a couple big physics discoveries last week. This is one of them, these low-frequency gravitational waves. Sarah, now you've found these low-frequency waves. In turn, what does that start to tell us about, I guess not just our galaxy, but about the universe?
Well, this is really exciting for us. We're just at the beginning of this story. We are just starting to see evidence of gravitational waves, but there's still a lot of questions that we have about, you know, the nature of this signal and what kind of source is producing it. So I mentioned supermassive black holes, but that's just one theory for what could be producing them. There are lots of other theories. That's part of why we're doing this experiment. That's why we're making these measurements, so that we can learn what actually is out there emitting these low frequency gravitational waves. A lot of these sources that we're excited about are things that either we can't see through electromagnetic observations, or, you know, we can, but it's difficult. And if we are able to use gravitational waves and electromagnetic observations, that will give us even more information.
You mentioned general relativity earlier, one of Einstein's, one of his big ideas. How does this discovery and the previous discovery of gravitational waves fit into confirming what he had proven, I guess, mathematically, 100 plus years ago?
Gravitational waves are a really important prediction of general relativity. So just the fact that we're able to observe them directly is an important test. But they also let us study gravity itself in a lot of detail. So gravitational waves in general relativity have two polarizations. You know, you might be familiar with the idea that light is polarized, like you might have polarized sunglasses that let through some of the light, but they block other light. Gravitational waves also come in two polarizations in general relativity, but in other theories of gravity, there might be extra polarizations. So that's a really important test that we can do with these gravitational wave detectors. We can go out and look and see if there is any evidence of extra polarizations. If there is, that would be a groundbreaking discovery. If not, that lets us put limits on how far away the theory of gravity can be from general relativity.
100 years in the making in some ways, 15 years of data collection led to this point for NanoGrav. What comes next?
A lot more. We have a lot of other gravitational wave searches we want to do with this data set. I mean, this data set, we've already done a lot of analyses on it, but we have even more to do searching for different types of gravitational wave sources. And the thing that I'm most excited about is working with our international collaborators. So at the same time, we had gravitational wave results published by the European Pulsar Timing Array, the Indian Pulsar Timing Array, the Parkes Pulsar Timing Array, and the Chinese Pulsar Timing Array. And NanoGrav and its international collaborators are going to be creating a combined data set where we take all of our data and make one giant data set, and then we're going to search that for gravitational waves. That will allow us to get even better measurements of this signal.
What's been the most exciting part of this process for you?
It's just incredibly exciting to be doing something that's never been done before, really on the frontier of science, you know, opening this new window on the universe. I'm really excited to see what we actually find.
Sarah, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing your research with us.
Thank you.
Sarah Vigeland is an assistant professor of physics at UW-Milwaukee. She's chair of the Gravitational Wave Detection Working Group at NanoGrav. She joined us to talk about NanoGrav's recent announcement about low-frequency gravitational waves that ripple through, you know, the fabric of space. Up next, we'll be hearing from another Wisconsin scientist about another big discovery, this one from our own Milky Way galaxy. That's coming up next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation on recent discoveries in physics. Last week, scientists at UW-Madison's Ice Cube Neutrino Observatory announced they detected subatomic ghost particles coming from within our own galaxy. A Wisconsin physicist joins us now for a look at that discovery, what it means for the future of astrophysics. You could join in if you've been following the progress of Ice Cube and the search for neutrinos at 800-642-1234. Join in with your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Jim Madsen is interim director of the Wisconsin Ice Cube Particle Astrophysics Center at UW-Madison. Jim, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks, Rob.
Let's start again with the basics here. Neutrinos, what are they?
Yeah, so neutrinos are fundamental particles, which means they don't have any inner bits, and they are produced when other particles change identities. So it could be, for example, radioactive decay.
And I mentioned they're sometimes called ghost particles. These are hard to find. Can you talk about the challenge of detecting neutrinos in the first place?
Yeah, so it's one of these strange things where the issue isn't that there's not enough of them. It's the issue is that they're essentially invisible. So they go streaming right through easier than light can go through glass. So you have to be very clever and build giant detectors in order to catch a few of them.
And that takes us to Ice Cube in Antarctica. Can you tell us how you hunt for neutrinos down there?
Yeah, so what we need is a large chunk of clear material, and that's both to have something for the neutrino to bump into, and then once it bumps into that, to create other particles that are visible. And so the first people who tried to do this were working in water, either deep in oceans or seas or in Lake Baikal in Russia. But in 1987, Francis Hollison got the idea, maybe you could put light sensors down in the ice and that would work even better. And so surprisingly, it turned out to be right. And we're the only detector that's big enough to explore space this way.
That takes us to the new announcement. Now, I've talked to people from Ice Cube before about detecting neutrinos, long-distance neutrinos from outside our galaxy. Well, here we are. The call is coming from inside the Milky Way. What did we find here?
Yeah, so the kind of unexpected thing from when we first came up with the idea to build this is that we wouldn't see our galaxy as one of the first objects because it's the closest, right? And so what we've did is come up with a clever way to sort out all the competing signals we are seeing in order to make our neighborhood visible. So kind of like, trying to mask out sounds when you're at a party so that you can hear the person that's standing next to you talking.
And when we're talking about neutrinos, now, of course, when we think of light, it travels at the speed of light. So we know how long it takes to get from point A to point B. How fast are these neutrinos going?
Yeah, so these neutrinos are essentially going at the speed of light. They have a small amount of mass, so they can't quite get to exactly the speed of light, but they have such high energy that to a good approximation saying that they are going at the speed of light is pretty close.
Now, in a
race, they would lose, but just by a small amount of light.
When you detect neutrinos, whether from Milky Way galaxy or beyond, what is creating them? What are the things out there that are setting them shooting our way?
So that's kind of the neat part of the story is that's our next question we want to answer. And amazingly, even though we've been studying the galaxy with many different types of telescopes, the very high energy aspects of it are still unknown. So I wish I could tell you that answer, but you know, one likely type of source would be left over from a star exploding, like which is called a supernova remnant. So, but the amazing thing is We still don't know.
We're talking to Jim Madsen, interim director of the Wisconsin Ice Cube Particle Astrophysics Center at UW-Madison, looking at their recent discovery, neutrinos. They've spotted those before in this research station in Antarctica. Now they're finding them within our own Milky Way galaxy. Jim, are we at a point where we could say the Milky Way galaxy produces fewer neutrinos than its sister and brother galaxies out there in the universe?
Yeah, Francis Hausland likes to say it's a neutrino desert. So it turns out it's not as prolific as the other galaxies, and that's one of the intriguing questions. Why? What makes it different? And that tells us something about either the types of sources that are in our galaxy or maybe about the environment around the central black hole in our galaxy. There's something that's fundamentally different that makes it produce fewer neutrinos than, say, this one that we discovered last fall that's millions of light years away but easier to find than our own neighborhood.
What you've started to touch on this a little bit already. What are we hoping to learn now by studying neutrinos and those from Milky Way, the Milky Way galaxy, versus those from elsewhere? What are some of the questions you're hoping to start answering?
Yeah, so the amazing thing is nature has figured out a way to accelerate particles to a billion times more energy than the best laboratories we've built on Earth. And we have no idea how that happens, or even aside from a few places that we've discovered now with Ice Cube, where that's happening. So one of the things we want to do is understand that, and that may open up totally new ideas of physics. And then what's neat about Ice Cube is it actually has multiple things it studies at the same time. So the neutrinos themselves are still not well understood, and they do amazing things. Like, they have three types of neutrinos, and they can be created as one type but show up as another. And so the only particles we know that can do that. So we're trying to understand not only these amazing sources out in space, but also the properties of this neutrinos that tell us about those objects.
I want to talk about the challenges of doing this kind of work, right? Detecting these incredibly difficult to detect particles and maintaining a research station basically at the South Pole, right? Deep into Antarctica. What are some of the challenges of doing high-tech research in this incredibly remote and inhospitable location?
Yeah, it's, so it starts with good design of the experiment. You know, so all the instruments that were put down on the ice have to function flawlessly in order for the experiment to work, and they have to keep working. And so the neat thing is some of these detectors now have been in the ice for close to 20 years, and still, as Francis says, tick like a Swiss watch. And so the other big challenge is the station is only open for about 3 months of the year. So we actually hire two people each year to spend 13 months at the South Pole.
Wow.
If something does break on the surface, like, for example, once in a while, one of the computer hard drives will crash or something like that, they can repair that. But the good news is that it's mostly super robust and working extremely well. The facility is collecting data at 99.5% of the time. So it's been a tremendous success.
Back to neutrinos themselves. As I understand it, I mean, we're constantly, right, awash with neutrinos. There are lots of them, I don't know, probably passing through me right now without any indication that they've been there. Do I have that right when it comes to their abundance and the way they don't interact with most of what they go through?
Yeah, that's right. One of the crazy facts that I like to tell people is you have 100 trillion neutrinos going through your body every second. And in your lifetime, you might capture one. So if you had ideas of being a neutrino experiment, you're no good, right?
And just in our last few moments, Jim, what is next? What are some of the next questions you're hoping to answer with Ice Cube?
Yeah, so the next steps are to better understand where these neutrinos are being produced in our galaxy. So right now, if you've seen the images, that map's pretty fuzzy, but we have some ideas on how to sharpen that up. We have some other galaxies that we think we'll be able to resolve soon. And then, as I said, studying the fundamental properties of the neutrinos themselves is a big part of our mission now. So we're going to have insights into how these neutrinos change from one type to the other and what that tells us about the way the universe works.
Jim, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much, Rob.
That's Jim Madsen, Interim Director of the Wisconsin Ice Cube Particle Astrophysics Center at the UW-Madison. He talked to us about the subatomic ghost particles originating from within our own Milky Way galaxy. That discovery just announced last week. One of two stories we've talked about with Wisconsin researchers about fundamental properties of our universe. Some mind-blowing stuff.